Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined by no one. It's just me. No Martin today because he is off doing his antiquing. He is an expert, of course, at antiques, as you may know. So he is hired to appraise very important things, and that's what he is up to. However, I have so much to talk about this morning that I probably will not need him this morning. Not that he isn't a necessary and important part of the show. I love good old Martin. But we have a lot of news to cover. So first I want to talk about our guest. So our guest today is Philip Mantle. This was recorded just before this big news broke for the weekend. So Philip and I are actually not talking about that. We're talking about Pascagoula, this new book that he has put out there. It was actually published many years ago, and he's republishing it. And it's great because it's an incredible case, as you'll hear about when Philip and I talk about it in just a minute. Philip, of course, is an author and a writer in the UK. He is a contributor to Open Minds. So it was kind of fun because it was like 11 o'clock in the morning when my time when we did the interview, but it was already the evening out there for him. But he's really great. You probably now recognize him from the stories he writes at openminds.tv. But he publishes a lot of books, and this is his latest. So we'll be talking about that in just a bit. You might have also heard me on Coast to Coast last night. So let's get into this. And why? Because of this big news I keep referring to that broke this weekend. Most of you have probably heard about it. Maybe some of you haven't. And if you haven't, then you are in for a treat. So here's what happened. The New York Times broke a big story, and it has to do with our good buddy Tom DeLonge. People either love or hate good old poor Tom DeLonge, but he's really important, and this story demonstrates that, and we'll talk about that and why that is the case. But essentially, Tom kept saying, there's big news coming, there's big news coming. Then I got some news from George Knapp, the journalist in Las Vegas, who broke the story about Bob Lazar. He's also a host occasionally on Coast to Coast AM. And he'll usually bring me on once a year at about this time in order to talk about the cases of the year, so the best UFO stories of the year. But he told me there might be a big story breaking that will probably take up most of the show if you come on Sunday night. And that big story did break. It broke on Saturday. So Leslie Kane is one of the people who broke this story. Her and a couple other authors wrote a story in the New York Times, and I'll be interviewing Leslie Kane later this week, and this is going to be a special report that I will post soon after I interview her, but we decided, you know, let's post this as soon as after I interview her as possible, because there's so much changing with this story and so much happening, and it's evolving and will probably continue to evolve. Not only that, what, Sunday's Christmas Eve and Monday is Christmas, so we'll get this out probably on Saturday to you all, so you'll have the latest and greatest on that. But the story that Leslie helped write was about a secret UFO program in the Department of Defense. Bum, bum, bum. So that's a big story, and that is extraordinary because, of course, the government saying they have been out of the UFO business for many, many years. However, you and I know that is not true. That is not the case. So, you know, we've got a video online that hopefully some of you have seen on the Open Minds YouTube channel where we cover, you know, here's how the Air Force is continuing to investigate UFOs. And it just demonstrated, and we've had John Greenwald on to talk about this and others, Paul Dean. He's been a great contributor to demonstrate some of these cases. Paul Dean from Australia. So we know they've been investigating UFOs. What we didn't know is that the Department of Defense had their own program. It was called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. Now, we did find out about this months ago. And when? In October, so just a couple months ago, we found out as part of the press conference. So Leslie, last time I had Leslie Kane on, we talked about Tom DeLonge's press conference, and she had written this story on this about starting this To the Stars Academy. And one of the people we talked about was this Louis Elizondo, this guy who was part of this DOD program. And, you know, Leslie and I talked about how what big news this is and what a big deal it was. And it didn't seem like a lot of people cared. Behind the scenes, people did care. So the New York Times jumped on it. They've been investigating this whole situation for the last 2 months. So has the Washington Post. And so has Politico. And maybe even others that we're not aware of yet. The New York Times posted their story on this situation on Saturday. Politico then posted theirs soon after, I think within a few minutes. And then the Washington Post posted theirs soon after as well. So these were the three big ones. By now, every major media outlet has covered it. So I just got done doing an interview with a local Phoenix outlet. So it'll be in there as well. And probably your local news is covering it wherever you are as well. So it's becoming this huge story that the Department of Defense has been investigating UFOs. Here's how it breaks down. And some of the major players, which and it's terribly interesting. So in 2007, Harry Reid, who was, he's a Democrat in the Senate. He was a majority leader. He's retired now. But he was friends with Bob Bigelow. Of course, I talk about Bob Bigelow all the time. And Bob Bigelow, of course, is into UFOs. He's a rich billionaire real estate magnate in Nevada who has also started up Bigelow Aerospace and has been working with NASA. He was on 60 Minutes not long ago talking about UFOs and how he believes UFOs are real and were being visited by extraterrestrials. So Bigelow obviously is a big deal. Well, he and Harry Reid are friends, and he had convinced Harry Reid that the government needed to start another UFO research organization. Harry Reid, this is another really interesting part of the story. So the New York Times was able to interview Harry Reid, and Harry Reid says that John Glenn, the astronaut, had also told him this, has also said, hey, you really need to look into UFOs, especially cases from some of my buddies, these Air Force pilots. And so, and we've never known that John Glenn, at least I don't know of any public reports or statements regarding John Glenn knowing or, I mean, even being interested in UFOs. So Harry Reid said John Glenn had also convinced him that this was a real phenomenon. So Harry Reid went and got support from a couple of his colleagues, a senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye, and then also Ted Stevens, a Republican from Alaska, and they were able to earmark some funds, just shy of $22 million, to start this department to investigate UFOs. They called the department the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. I kind of feel that that name even has some of Bigelow's signature on it, because Bigelow used to have an organization that researched a lot of paranormal phenomena called the Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies. This was part of his Bigelow Aerospace company. In fact, as we've probably talked about before, the Bigelow Aerospace hangars, the big hangars, have an alien face on them. And what's funny about this, and this is probably one of the more shocking parts of the story, is not only have they been investigating UFOs, but Louis Elizondo says that they had to modify some of Bigelow's hangars or buildings in order to also house material that they had retrieved. Very mysterious statement, and that this material is something that they don't know what it is, that it's a technology of some sort that was created by someone that they don't believe was Chinese or Russians. Elizondo kind of alludes to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but that this is technology we don't understand. He also, you know, states that when it comes to unknowns, we have to consider them a threat until we know otherwise, and that this technology that's being demonstrated is something we cannot defend ourselves against currently. So if this technology was used against us, we would be in a bit of trouble. Of course, there's been lots of speculation about that. John Alexander, for example, has talked about that. Nick Pope wrote a story. John Alexander was an Army intelligence colonel who's retired, and Nick Pope used to work for the UK's Ministry of Defense doing something similar to what Elizondo is doing, researching UFOs. Nick Pope hasn't talked about ever retrieving any material like Elizondo has, but Nick Pope had also written kind of an article, a faux top secret document about what we would do if aliens attacked, which kind of said we're screwed. Kind of just do your final prayers and maybe boost your karma because it's over is what his report concluded. Luckily, that has not happened. Now, they did release a couple of videos from cases they have investigated. One of those cases and one of those videos we are already aware of. In fact, I had Robert Powell on the show to talk about the Nimitz case. And that's one of the cases that they talked about along with video that they released. So at least we can confirm that the DOD did investigate that. That was a legitimate case. The video's legitimate. The other video that they released is similar. However, it is, we don't know where it came from or when. They haven't released anything else. And Elizondo kind of said he kind of was being tricky. He tricked the Department of Defense into allowing him to release those videos, kind of saying that they were going to be for training, not really saying that they were, you know, going to be part of his UFO investigation, UFO investigation that he's continued to do. What's interesting about this, though, is that many of the cases, or at least these two cases, are very similar to cases Nick Pope has talked about, similar to cases that Cefa'a in Chile has talked about, or cases in France. You know, there is this pattern of military UFO sightings where an object is seen, jets are scrambled, and the object zooms off at incredible speed. I mean, we've seen this over and over and over and over again, and there are probably thousands of government documents that talk about this. One of the best cases of this ever happening, I feel, is in the Blue Book files in 1952, when in the summer, you know, this happened over Dulles Airport Base or Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. And one of the times this occurred, the Blue Book personnel were actually there. They were in the tower watching this all go down. Jets being scrambled, objects fly away, jets go away, and the objects came back in that instance, which is something that happened. So we see the same patterns. But Elizondo is convinced that this is technology that is beyond what we can create. And as we know, the To the Stars Academy organization wants to glean what they can from observing this technology to use it to develop our own technology. However, the big difference here is this material. Chris Mellon was on the show with us last night on Coast to Coast. Chris Mellon Martin has had the opportunity to interview him. Unfortunately, I have not yet. But Chris Mellon was a National Security Affairs Advisor or is for To the Stars. And that's a role he's played officially. He's worked for the CIA. He was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence in the Clinton and Bush administrations. He was also Minority Staff Director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So he's done some really incredible stuff. He also drafted legislation that established the U.S. Special Operations Command. So, you know, he's done a lot of incredible stuff. Leslie Kane wrote a story about him and his interest in UFOs a couple years ago that also made a lot of news. But he's very conservative. He's very careful about how and what he does in this field. And he is part of To the Stars Academy and was on the show with us last night. And I asked him, you know, if these materials were really obtained, wouldn't this help you all if you can get a hold of it and on, you know, figuring more out and developing technology? And he acknowledged that, yes, it does seem that this material was obtained, that it does seem to be technology that we don't yet understand. But he didn't say, and it hasn't been released, how this material was obtained. Was something crashed and recovered? We don't know that. And George Knapp last night also said he doesn't know that. So it's a pretty incredible situation. We haven't had that before, where there's been an admission that there's been some material that we don't know what it is. The other thing that I think is really important here is that Tom DeLonge, on his own, started this initiative. So he's the one, and this is why we gave him the Researcher of the Year Award last year at the UFO Congress, even though many people disagree with that decision, and some have been very upset about it, and they have expressed their just disgust for us to doing this. But I think that it was justified at that time because the WikiLeaks. So essentially what happened was, and I've reviewed this before, but for some people who maybe need a refresher, and you know, you all don't live this every day like I do, so you probably need kind of a reminder. But John Podesta, his emails were leaked. He was a campaign manager for Hillary Clinton, and it was a big deal. You know, this whole Russia thing that's going on now, is was Trump involved or not? And we'll find out. But the point was that, to me, the most interesting thing that was revealed was that Podesta was working with Tom DeLonge, and they were talking with some very high-level officials about UFOs, and that's why Tom DeLonge got the award, because he took the initiative to do that. And nobody has had conversations at that level, as far as UFO researchers, civilian people who are interested in this topic, but Tom DeLonge did. And that's important. That opens so much up, and this is a result. So months later, finally in October, they start the To the Stars Academy. And now there's a different group of retired officials that Tom has put together and has been able to talk to and convince to work together and come out publicly about their interest in this topic and research UFOs. This is what inspired Lou Elizondo to come out. So Lou Elizondo was working for the Department of Defense investigating UFOs, frustrated that he felt the Department of Defense was not taking this information seriously enough. In fact, we found out in these stories that the Pentagon funded the program from 2007 to 2012 when they cut off funding because they felt they weren't getting enough from the program. Well, they try to make it sound as if the program ended at that time, but as Lou says, it didn't end. He continued running it up until October when he left, and even when he left, there was a successor, so it's still going on. When he left, he partly it was because of this To the Stars Academy. He felt, wow, I can leave the DOD and go work with these other people who have also worked in intelligence, some of whom I know, and do this sort of work outwardly for the benefit of the public. And so it was because this To the Stars Academy platform existed that allowed Lou Elizondo to come out of the DOD and continue to do this work publicly. And that also then allowed us all to find out about this DOD program and allowed this weekend to happen, this news, this thing that's going on right now, these huge news stories. I'm sure, you know, the show, if you're listening on KGRA, everybody's probably talking about this. And all the people on all of the podcasts. So it's a really, really big deal. So I guess that's what I know. I've talked to Tom for a bit. He's swamped. I've talked to Leslie Kane a little bit, and she's going to talk more on Friday. So next weekend, we'll have more information and the latest greatest information for you. But this is the big news. You can go to openminds.tv, and I do have a poster with all of the links to all of these places, all of these stories that I've talked about, and more. There's more stories popping up by the minute on this whole situation. Also, you'll want to go to the To the Stars link, because there you're going to see the videos and all the information that we have on these videos. But yeah, this is a really extraordinary situation. So I think it's great that Tom DeLonge got this done. And I know, you know, there's a lot of criticism because Tom talks about all of these situations with aliens and versus the America and these battles and stuff going on. I don't know that any of that is happening. And I think I've said this before, that I've spoken at least with Jem Semivan. I know Chris Mellon's perspective, that they don't aren't aware of anything like that going on. I think that they both are perhaps, well, I don't know for sure. I know. I think that Chris Mellon is skeptical that something to that level is going on. But the question is, was this organization in the DOD the end-all be-all? Has that been the only UFO investigation since 1969, when they closed Project Blue Book? We know they've been investigating UFOs, but we don't know of any project that has been created specifically for that purpose. Some of you may know I'm highly, highly skeptical of the Majestic 12 documents, or this idea behind those documents. And I have another video on why, because those are hoaxed. I mean, the person who put those out, essentially, or the first document says he hoaxed it. He made that whole thing up. So I'm skeptical of that. But were there other programs? Elizondo said he was disappointed that they didn't take it more seriously. People such as Alan J. Hynek or J. Allen Hynek in Blue Book said they had felt the same way, but we found out that there were other levels of research going on that they just weren't aware of. Could that be the case with Elizondo, that there are other organizations researching, maybe even with more resources, that he just isn't aware of? We don't know. Also, what does Bigelow know? What is this material? How much does Bigelow have? What's interesting about this is that, you know, George Knapp has interviewed Bigelow a couple times, the 60 Minutes thing. While all of these interviews were happening and he was saying that aliens are real, at that same time, he's working with NASA and he's working behind the scenes with the DOD on this other UFO investigation project. So the implications to all of this are huge. And of course, just like everything with UFOs, the more we find out, the more questions we have. And it seems like in this situation, we've got many more answers, but an astronomical amount of questions that come along with it. So continue to watch openminds.tv, can continue to listen to this podcast, and we will bring you all of the news as it comes. And of course, you'll definitely want to go to the UFO Congress, because that's where you're going to get the latest, and you're going to be able to talk to dozens of people who are researchers, who know a lot and have dedicated their lives to this field, to get their opinions and perspectives on all of this. No doubt, this is going to be a huge topic at the Congress, and we hope to have, and we will have, some sort of representation, or at least some sort of presentation we'll be discussing this at the UFO Congress. And I think we may have some really cool things in store for you along those lines. So stay tuned for that. But let's go ahead and talk to Philip Mantle. If you're listening on KGRA, there'll be a couple commercials, and then we'll be back. If you're listening on the podcast, there'll be a short musical interlude, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas. You're listening to Open Mind UFO Radio, and I am joined by, from across the pond, as they say, Philip Mantle. Hello.
Good evening.
So, yeah, evening for you. So we're recording. We pre-record, the audience knows that, but for me, it's first thing in the morning. For you, it is the evening.
Yes, it's dark here and cold, Alejandro, so yes, it's definitely the evening.
So, do you have snow on the ground? Are you going to have a white Christmas out there?
We have no snow at the moment. We've had some, and some ice, but no snow at the moment, but it's just cold.
Mm-hmm. And what area do you live in?
I'm in the north of England. I live in a town called Pontefract, and I'm in the county of West Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. 15 miles from the city of Leeds.
Okay, cool. So interesting. Very interesting. So it's great to have you back on the show, and you've been doing some really interesting things lately. You, of course, are a contributor for Open Minds TV, and we greatly, greatly appreciate that. You're always bringing us some breaking and interesting news. And actually, let's just talk about that for a second. The last story you brought us, and I was wondering, you know, your thoughts on this. It was one of those kind of too-good-to-be-true UFO photo stories, but you took, like you do, which I appreciate, a kind of unbiased approach where you kind of gather what the pro and con people are saying about it. And what, I guess, led you to believe there was something more to those photos that, you know, were you hearing some, like, I think Bruce McAbee, who's a Navy physicist, to hear him say that he's on the fence on those photos is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Alejandro, I just saw one of the photographs. There are several, there's a handful, on Facebook. And that looks interesting, not seen anything like that. And there was only a little bit of information to go with it. So I sent the chap who posted the message a private message just saying, that's interesting, any more information? And then a short while later, the post had been taken down. And I thought, well, that's curious. So I contacted him again, and eventually, slowly but surely, the gentleman who we call Keith, although that's not his real name, he said that, you know, he had a group of these photographs that were taken by him at the China Lake facility 10 years ago. And that he politely suggested to begin with that I look more at the facility and what it did than the photographs. So I did that, and I found that the China Lake facility was a military base that had tested a lot of weaponry down the years. A lot of new weapons were tested there. No secret, although it's a classified installation, its use is well known. And the story he told me behind it was that he used to live nearby, and he had a friend that used to work there. And his friend said, you know, there's something been going on the base. You know, we've had a lot of the top brass here, but I don't know what it is, you know. So Keith managed to sneak onto the base himself. I mean, I'm led to believe that large parts of it anyway, Alejandro, are just open desert or open scrubland. So, and to his amazement, he saw this thing, and he took a number of photographs of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kept these photographs on an old laptop for a number of years and never really showed them to anyone. He wasn't so much worried about the taking of the photographs, but in what he told me was he was scared that he'd broken the law by going on to the base. And it was that worried him. And he himself thought there could be some kind of weapon or drone or, you know, something that was being tested. So, you know, I tried to squeeze as much information from him as I could. He said he'd had trouble with the old laptop trying to download the photographs. He managed to get them on his phone. Anyway, he sent me copies of them. And I thought, well, like this kind of photographic case, I'll have the experts look at it, Alejandro. So I sent it to Dr. Bruce Maccabee in the States, Jason Gleaves here in the UK, another gentleman in Sweden, and even some colleagues in South America, in Brazil, and asked them what they made of it. And they all, to my surprise, came back with quite different answers. I mean, as you mentioned there, Dr. Maccabee, he's on the fence. He thinks it might be something, if it's not a fake, he thinks that the object might be something small. Jason Gleaves in the UK, he thinks it's authentic. My colleague in Sweden, he thinks he's not so sure. He leans towards more it being a fake. And the gentleman in South America, you know, had no hesitation in labelling it as a hoax. So I thought, well, you know, to get more people involved in looking at this and perhaps shine, you know, shed a bit more light on it, Alejandro, it's best to write this article and publish it, which I have done. And you've published it on Open Minds, and it's caused quite a bit of debate. So I've now been able to go back to the photographer and try and elicit some more information from him. And if I do, then, you know, we'll all find out about it. But it certainly caused some debate. But as I pointed out, you know, in the opening part of it, when you get a UFO photograph today, you instantly go on the defensive simply because of the kind of software that is available, Alejandro. You know, people can just make in their own home, which in the pre-digital age, it was more difficult to do that. Not impossible, but more difficult. Mm-hmm. You're always on the defensive. So I've kept open-minded about it. If I'm honest, I would say I lean towards the skeptical side of it. But, you know, I'm willing to have my mind changed, so to speak. But nonetheless, it's out in the public domain now, and maybe others can, you know, shed a bit more light on it and see exactly what it may or may not be. We'll have to see.
Yeah, you know, I come about it similar, these cases, like you said, and I feel the same way with this one, skeptical, but open to what people may have to say. When people like Bruce Maccabee lend their input, I think it's important to listen with his credentials and background. And I kind of feel the same. I feel skeptical. I feel like, this is probably nothing. I don't think it's much. But as a responsible, I guess, journalist, an open-minded person, you still pursue the input from the experts, especially kind of hoping maybe that you'll be proven wrong, which is always kind of nice that there's something more mysterious there that perhaps you overlooked. So that's why I think these sorts of cases, even though, you know, people may quickly kind of disavow them or kind of move away from it, are worth delving into.
Well, yeah, I mean, it looked like one way or another it was going to get into the public domain. So I thought, well, perhaps it would be better if it went into the public domain with some kind of information behind it and some kind of expertise surrounding it as well, like Bruce and others. You know, like I say, I'm like you, I'm a little bit skeptical. If it's not a hoax, then I thought perhaps it might be some kind of targeting device that they, you know, used to shoot at or to aim at or whatever. I don't know. I'm not an expert in these fields. But the only way we were going to find that out, Alejandro, is to make it widely available. Mm-hmm. And someone come forward and said, oh, yeah, I was at such and such a base and we used to, you know, would load them things up and fire at them, but they didn't work properly, or it was never tested properly, or whatever. Or someone might come forward and say, well, I know the photographer, and I know his real name, and I can tell you it's a hoax. So well, I have to wait and see what happens. But if I do find out any more information, of course, I will keep you informed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excited for that. And you know what else I find these good? You talked about the debate that it had raised, and I knew it would, because on one of our UFO groups, you know, Mark D'Antonio, who does photo analysis for MUFON, had come forward and said he felt there was a problem with the shadows, and others had said, you know, these definitely are not real. But it sparks that debate, which I think is healthy. And it's also these stories I think you can use as vehicles for educating the public. For instance, on China Lake, which is an interesting area and facility. And now that at least there's some more awareness there. Although I am a little skeptical, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I don't think it'd be very easy to get into China Lake, at least areas where they're doing testing.
Well, that's something I can't comment about. I've never tried it, and but again, if we put that information out into the public domain, maybe there's others that have worked there or lived nearby where this gentleman claimed to have lived, will be able to tell us one way or another that they may be able to sneak on it. I mean, I don't know. People managed to get onto Area 51, and there's no way you can secure such a huge installation. So maybe he just got lucky, Alejandro, who knows, or maybe it's prank, you know, but it certainly never asks for any money or doesn't want his name, you know, he's not after any notoriety or anything like that. Of course, that doesn't mean it's not a fake, I understand where you're coming from, but again, you know, if we release the story, then, you know, others can help, you know, supply information that may count towards it or not. Regarding the shadows, it's a valid point. However, you know, I remember reading about people arguing that man didn't go to the moon, because when you see them standing on the moon, the shadows go in different directions. But there is a logical explanation for that. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point. Excuse me. Here's another question I would like to ask you, kind of along the lines of all of this, is... Sorry, I was getting a little bit of feedback. There we go. Is, you know, your perspective, when you approach this field and this phenomena, what is your approach? Do you take more of a journalistic approach? Are you someone who, you know, believes there is a real mystery, or you're not sure and you're exploring whether there's a real mystery to all of this?
Well, I think I know there's a mystery, Ali. I don't need any more convincing. I'm not sure what that mystery is. I've had a couple of sightings myself that, you know, I couldn't explain. So I don't need any convincing. However, we know from experience that the vast majority of UFO sightings, some people will say 95%, you know, can be explained. I would argue that it's a lot more than that, Alejandro, that a genuine UFO sighting is very rare. And therefore, whenever I get a photograph coming or a sighting, I always start off with that in mind, that, you know, the vast majority of these, you know, reports have a logical explanation behind them. Sometimes we can't find that, but it doesn't mean there isn't one there anyway. We just might not have enough information. Certainly when it comes to what I call the close encounter cases, I think they're even more rare. And a peculiar thing about when we're talking about photography and film, Alejandro, is that I think we have, you know, a small amount of photographic evidence that we, you know, could well be authentic. However, when it comes to the stranger aspects of the phenomena, or as Alan Hynek called them, high strangeness, then the physical stroke photographic evidence seems to fall away. And a colleague of mine, Russell Callahan, I remember a presentation that he did not so long ago, talked about this particular area, whereby certainly in the Western world, today we are surveyed by millions of closed-circuit TV cameras for one reason or another. And, you know, the general population, how many millions of us carry a mobile phone, or a cell phone, as you would call it, that have, you know, video or photographic facilities built in. Yet the quality of the video, so UFO images, film images, seems to get worse. You know, we often quote that the best photograph, you know, this is arguable, but is the one taken by Paul Trent at McMinnville back in the 1950s. Well, you know, surely if we're still having these sightings today, we can get something better than that. But it seems that perhaps Russ is correct, that the photographic evidence has gone in the opposite direction. And we don't really, if we're honest, in my opinion, have any credible photographs or film of the real high strangeness incidents, of which I've investigated a number, and I have no doubt in their authenticity, Alejandro. I'm not casting any doubt on them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big question for the UFO community, is why don't we? And it's not one that raised, you know, not a question that is raised very often. And it's a peculiar part of it. So that's how I start. I know that most, if not certainly not all, but most UFO sightings that are reported, whether they've got film or photographs, really doesn't matter. They have a conventional explanation at the end of the day. So that's where I start from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great perspective. Speaking of, you know, these strange cases or these cases with entities like you had brought up, some of which you feel, which are interesting and have some credibility to them. I feel there are a handful of cases. You have recently reprinted a book on one of those very interesting cases, and this is the Pascagoula case.
I have indeed. I mean, you know, when I first became interested in this subject, it was the late 1970s. So it's long before the digital age. And the only way you could find out any information really was by reading, you know, books, a few magazines that were around, or perhaps joined a local UFO group, which I did all of those. And I remember reading about the Pascagoula incident with Hickson and Parker, Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. And it was one of the first that I actually read about, and I was, you know, astonished by it, certainly because of its peculiarities. And there are many with it. There are many peculiarities, and it stayed with me ever since. You know, it's one of those that's always been in the back of my mind. And I think one of the reasons I think it's largely gone been forgotten in a lot of instances, Alejandro, is because it's had no flag bearer. I mean, would we still be hearing about Travis Walton were it not for Travis himself? I mean, he'd largely, you know, carried on with his life up until the movie Fire in the Sky. It's only since then that he's gone, you know, more so on the lecture scene, along with one or two things now and again. But, of course, Charles Hickson did that in the early days after Pascagoula, but Calvin Parker didn't. And once Charles had passed away, then it had no torchbearer. So I went online and I was amazed to see the cost of buying a second-hand copy of the UFO Contact at Pascagoula. That's the name of the book. I mean, it was extortionate. So I assumed, wrongly as it turned out, that someone else must have republished it somewhere along the line. And, of course, they hadn't. So I sought out the necessary permission. And because it wasn't in any kind of a file, I had to sit down and literally retype the whole book, which made sure I read it. Which I did. I retyped it. It's unabridged, word for word. Even the illustrations. The only thing that's different about it is I put a one page in memoriam at the back because Charles Hickson had died. And then, of course, now we're in the digital age, and I was sent a list of files that you can access online, and you can listen to some of the interviews that these gentlemen did. And so I'll put that list and the website where you can find these. And that's the only difference. That, you know, that there is no difference at all to the actual text itself, to the manuscript. All the illustrations, the photographs, the whole lot are exactly the same. And I just find it a fascinating account. And for those that are thinking, what's he talking about? Well, it happened on October the 11th, 1973, on the Pascagoula River, Mississippi. And Charles Hickson was 42 years old at the time. Calvin Parker was 19. And they were fishing. You know, their great passion in life was to fish. And come around about, I think it was about 9 o'clock in the evening, and the, you know, like most fishing trips, they hadn't caught much, and they looked further up to an abandoned sort of pier, and thought, we'll give it one last go and then we'll head for home. And Charles turned around to get some bait. He got his first fish. He thought, great. And he was astonished at what he saw, and he turned back to look at his friend Calvin. And Calvin was stood there in sheer terror. And that's how the whole episode began for them. And that's how my interest, you know, spanned the decades about it. It didn't really have a torchbearer. So I'm not saying I will be that torchbearer, but I thought it was important enough to have that particular case back in the public domain, in print again, and not having to pay an extortionate price for one of the original copies. You can read it all now at a vastly reduced price, and hopefully be as fascinated with it all as I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to have been booked, because Open Minds, of course, as you know, acquired the Wendell Stevens collection, which included all of the books that he had published and all the copies he had left. And that was one book, that and UFOs Over China, where there were very few left. Everything else, you know, there are many copies left, and you can purchase those online at the openminds.tv store. But that was one. So my guess is that it must have sold very well, because it's a very interesting story. And I think the UFOs Over China did as well, because that is a great book. That's an incredible book. So it's really cool. I love it when publishers do this, when they find these obscure books, or books that are important or have great information, and then reprint them so they're available to the public. And like you said, you know, not at these crazy prices that these rare books are posted at.
Well, exactly. And what amazed me, I mean, I knew Charles Hickson was deceased, and I tried to find Calvin Parker. And fortunately, I have. I have been in touch with him. But before I did, I mean, I contacted a UFO group in Mississippi. I'm not going to mention who the group were, but I thought maybe they might know where he lives, or can get me an address. And to be honest, they'd never heard of the case. And I was absolutely astonished.
Wow.
So that kind of galvanized me and thought, well, I am doing the right thing, because you know, this what is a fascinating case. And what people don't realize is that Alan Hynek, the late Alan Hynek, was at Pascagoula within 48 hours of it happening. Wow. And he made a public statement to the press that these gentlemen are the genuine article. Mm-hmm. And
well, let's pause here. We've got to take a short break. So for those of you listening to KGRA, you'll hear a couple minutes of commercial. So be sure to patronize some of these great people. They help keep KGRA on the air. For those of you listening to the podcast, you'll just hear a slight musical interlude. And then I will be back with Philip Mantle talking about this terribly interesting Pascagoula case. So we'll talk more about a few of the details and why it's so interesting. And then we'll also get some more insight from Philip on his discoveries as he painstakingly retyped every single word in the book. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mind UFO Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and we are speaking with UK researcher, author, and publisher, Philip Mantle. Hello.
Hi there.
So, with the Pascagoula case, there's a couple things that make it terribly interesting. One being these creatures that they saw. Maybe you could describe these odd beings that they claim to have witnessed.
That's right, Alejandro. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Charles Hickson had turned around to get some fishing bait when he saw this peculiar-looking object descending. There was a blue light, and he's not convinced it touched the ground. It seemed to be, you know, almost hovering. It made no sound apart from a little zip, so he couldn't hear any engines or exhaust. I mean, that puzzled him along with everything else. A doorway opened, although he calls it a doorway. He's not sure of what it was. These three beings exited, and again, they didn't walk. They floated over the ground towards them. His description of them was they were, you know, average height, you know, less than 6 foot, but they had two legs, two arms, but their legs never moved, and their feet were like what he describes like elephant's feet, and on their head, where the ears would be, were like two, I can only describe it like carrot-shaped protrusions, and same where the nose might be on the front. There was no eyes, there was no mouth. The hands were more like claws that you might find on a crab or some kind of crustacean. And they were grey in colour from head to foot, these beings. And he described their I'll call it skin for want of a better word, as extremely wrinkly. And it totally bizarre. I mean, it as if the environment that was around them wasn't bad enough, these three beings freaked them out even further. And of course, two of them took hold of Charles Hickson and took him on board this thing, one of Calvin. At some point, Calvin was so terrified, you know, he blacked out. Inside this object, there was what Charles called an examining eye, like a huge round ball, but to him it was like an eye, and it went all the way around him as if it was taking some kind of measurements or x-ray or scanning him in some way. Now, you know, Charles himself was also terrified, but he'd been a soldier in the Korean War and had fought in four large major battles during that time, and I believe was also wounded. And he kind of sort of went back and used his experience in the military to help him through this. Because at one point, he was so frightened himself, he thought these beings were going to kill them. So rather than prolong it, he just said to himself in his head, you know, kill me now, you know, kill me now. But then he went back to his training in the Korean War and remembered one particular battle they were in, and they were pinned down by enemy fire, and his commanding officer just said, no, don't wait, you know, don't worry, just wait, and we'll have our chance to get, you know, to escape and get out of here alive. So that's what he did. So that, like I said, it's got a lot of peculiarities as the case, but one of the peculiarities is the descriptions of these beings. I'm not aware, although I may be mistaken, but I'm not aware of anyone else ever reporting anything that looked remotely like them. And so in that respect, they are unique. And if there's anybody listening who knows differently, I would love to hear from them, of course. But so the experience itself, Alejandro, was terrifying enough. But then seeing these things made it even worse for the two gentlemen in question. If you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
When they were returned back to whence they came, Charles was more worried about his friend Calvin. He was just sort of slumped there, dumbfounded, and he was yelling at him, you know, Calvin, 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 Calvin. Anyway, he finally roused him, and they took off. They weren't that far from the road, to be honest, and there's a bridge that goes over the river, and they'd parked their car there, but they didn't even know what time it was, Alejandro, because neither of them had a watch on. I mean, these were fishermen. They went fishing, and time didn't matter. So they got in the car, and Charles said, well, we're not going to tell anybody, they'll think we're nuts. So they decided to drive home. But during this drive, they have a conversation and said, no, we really should tell someone in case they might do this to someone else, or it's an invasion or whatever. So they find a call box, and they telephone Keesler Air Force Base. And they are not interested at all. They said, you know, the Air Force gave up this, looking into this phenomenon years back, you know, ring the deputy, ring your local police. So they get back in the car, disgruntled, and set off, again deciding to go home. And again, they change their mind. So they pull into another payphone and ring the sheriff's department. And the sheriff says, "Where are you? I'll arrange." And he arranged to come and meet them. And he sort of shepherded them back into town. They stopped in town at a newspaper office, not to report the incident, but they knew there was a large clock in the office. So they looked through the window just to see what time it was. So they went to the sheriff's department, told them the story several times. And the sheriff had kept them apart, you know, in separate rooms. But at one point, the sheriff put them in a room together and then left. Now, unbeknown to Parker and Hickson, the sheriff actually had a secret tape recorder in a desk that they were sat at, and he left it switched on. And he thought, right, I'll find out now, because they think I've gone. They don't know the tape recorder's running. And, you know, I'll hear them tell the real story about this prank. Well, of course, they didn't. When he later played the tape recorder to other staff members in the office, they hadn't revealed a prank. They were telling the same story and were still terrified. And I think even said a few prayers. They were that scared. Now, the story was released by the sheriff's department, much to the two gentlemen's surprise, and they weren't happy about it. So the story broke and went nationwide, and they were plagued by TV crews and newspapers and journalists from all over. Or people would just turn up at their house and knock on the door. And like I said, Alan Hynek was there within 48 hours. And he confirmed that, you know, he thought the gentlemen were authentic. They went to the Air Force base, told them the story, and so on. They thought, oh, what we'll do, because they were plagued by journalists. They thought, we'll take a couple of weeks off work, and then it will have all died down. But it just made things worse, you know. They were hounded. Now, Charles handled it better. Calvin took off and they couldn't really find him, and eventually, just a few weeks afterwards, he actually had a breakdown and ended up in hospital. And so it was Charles Hickson who felt that it was important, Alejandro, that other people should know about this, that it was important that this, you know, was something special, something fascinating about this event. So I think he did a couple of lectures for MUFON, and he did a lot of local things, and he even went on a famous TV show called The Dick Cavett Show. And that's where the author of the book, William Mendes, a college professor, that's where he became aware of the case. And he spent 3 years investigating the case. The two gentlemen were later hypnotized. They also had a full psychological checkup, if you like, passed with flying colors, although that was some years down the line, not at the time. But like I said, you know, since the passing of Charles, you know, the case has been largely forgotten. And I think it's a great shame, because it is part of our our history in ufology, and I don't think it should be forgotten.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those few cases with entities described that's very credible. And you know, one thing that's interesting, too, another thing that's getting forgotten is in the 70s, there was a wave. There were a few years where people were claiming more than usual to not only be seeing UFOs, but entities. And what's interesting about that wave back then is that the entities, the creatures that were described, were had much more variety and were much more strange than these days. Whereas these days, it's mostly the same thing reported, the big heads, the almond eyes. That's another reason I think that this case is important.
Well, I agree totally with you. I mean, there was a wave in that particular year, in 1973, and William Mendes mentions that, and in fact, he highlights, in brief, a few other cases, some that happened before the Pascagoula incident and some that happened afterwards. And again, they're fascinating in their own right. Mm-hmm. So, again, there's a question for ufology, Alejandro, is why, when this wave happened in the 1970s, did we have all these reports of humanoids that are vastly different than those that are reported today? Mm-hmm. And it's a question that I don't think that has any easy answers. And Pascagoula is a prime example of that. I'm not aware of anyone else ever reporting anything similar to these creatures whatsoever. Yet I don't have a moment's doubt that the Pascagoula incident is the genuine article, wherever that may be. And if it was good enough for Alan Hynek, it's good enough for me, I'm afraid. So. But it's a fascinating event. It really is. And, you know, I've always thought since I first read about it, I think it was in a magazine, my first brief information about it many years back, I always thought it would make a fantastic movie as well. But, mm-hmm. That's just the way I look at it. But it's a fascinating incident. And, I'm not just saying this because, I've published a book, but I would recommend people read about it. I really would.
Well, and you know, the Hynek rule that you said, if it's good enough for Hynek, it's good enough for me, I think it's a good one, because what a lot of people don't realize, Hynek is known for kind of nuts and bolts looking at UFOs. He, for people who don't know, although they should, I mention him quite a bit, professor of astronomy at Northwestern, very well known. He aided the Air Force in their UFO investigations from the beginning till they ended, and then continued looking into UFOs. He thought they were ridiculous when he started, very convinced there was a real phenomena at the end. And he did mostly stick to UFOs because, of course, entities is very controversial. But there are a couple cases, and I talked quite a bit about one of the cases, about the little green men and these weird Kentucky case, but this is another one where he investigated, and he actually felt that these were real events, that these people believed what happened to them.
Absolutely, and he was fortunate that he was able to speak to the witnesses in situ, within 48 hours of the incident happening. Now, he will have paid for that himself. I mean, he had to fly down there, Alejandro. So, I think that's to his credit. And, most of us don't have that opportunity. I mean, I've spoken to people, and I'm certainly sure you have, who've had encounter cases, but they were been and gone, And he also confirmed the trauma that these gentlemen were suffering from. So, it wasn't just, oh, yes, they're telling the truth. It was the effect that this incident had on them as well. He confirmed that. And it's difficult sometimes for us to try and look back and see that, how it would frighten the individuals. But it did. And he confirmed that. And, I think, like I said, if it's good enough for Dr. Hynek, it's good enough for me. Nothing will change that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting with this case, too, and I think some others where the entities that are witnessed are so strange, because that strangeness, I think, adds to the terror, even if they're not doing anything, you know, scary. Their actions aren't as scary. You know, if you think of the legends of the Sasquatch or some other things, these are, even with the big heads and the almond eyes, these are at least more familiar to us. If you see it, you recognize it, you've seen it in... But in this case, it's so foreign and strange just witnessing or being near something that is alive, if that's what happened, that is so odd and large, and it would be just a scary experience by itself.
Well, exactly. I think I mentioned that, you know, not only was the encounter frightening, because you have to remember, to begin with, when Charles Hixon first saw this object, there was no beings in sight, and he turned around to look at his friend Calvin, and he was already terrified. So then you add to that, into the mix, these three strange beings that didn't walk across the ground. They actually zipped over it. They hovered over it towards you. It terrified them even more. And Charles talks very openly about how frightened he was. Like I said, he thought they were going to kill him, and he wanted it over and done with. He literally says in his head, all right, kill me now. If you're going to kill me, do it now. Because he was so frightened. But obviously that didn't happen. So, yes, the whole event, you know, from beginning to end, and they estimated it only lasted about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. They tried to sort of look back and work out a timeline. Was terrifying from beginning to end. And like I said, Charles was better able to deal with it, Alejandro, perhaps because of his military training and the events he saw during the Korean War. Excuse me, Calvin was only 19 at the time, and he had a lot of trouble dealing with it. I think within 3 weeks he'd had a nervous breakdown. Wow. And I believe, you know, he had two more after that down the years. I have spoken to him briefly in the last few months, but there was a holiday you have in America. I don't know what it is. Was it Labor Day or something? But there was a holiday, so that got in the way. And I've said to him, I rang him again. Now there's another holiday coming up, which is Christmas, of course. So I said, I'll speak to him in the new year. In the meantime, you know, I have sent him a copy of the book UFO Contact at Pascagoula. And he's acknowledged the receipt of that. So it'd be interesting to speak to him. Because when I was writing the book, when I was rewriting it, I should say, you know, Charles Hixon had two or three sort of sightings after that. Now, the author, William Mendes, discounted, I think, the first two of them, because Charles Hixon was on his own. Again, he was out hunting, you know, in nearby. But the third incident was witnessed by his wife and family as well. They call it the Mother's Day incident. It was Mother's Day. They'd all gone out to see Charlie Hixon's mum and were returning in the car when this object approached and came down very near to landing. And that scared them as well. So when I was rewriting the book, I kept thinking, well, I wonder if anything like that happened to Calvin, you know, or did Calvin know about these other incidents? What did he make of it? So, you know, I kept having questions, you know, through parts of the book. And one of the things William Mendes does at the book, he does like questions and answer almost. So people will ask him questions. One of the questions at the back was, why isn't there more about Calvin Parker in the book? Calvin's involved at the beginning, but then he kind of fades away. It's simply because he didn't live in the area. He used to stay with Charles Hixon, but after the event he went back home, which I believe was 100 miles or so some away, and it terrified him so much he just washed his hands of it. He went on, not underground, but he didn't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Now, and I can understand that. Now, when I briefly spoke to him, just I think it was last month, he mentioned this part to me, and he said, well, I'm getting I'm getting on in life now, Philip. You know, I figured he told me how old he was, but I've forgotten. And he said, I want to put my side of the story on the record before it's too late. You know, he said people locally, you know about him, will mention it to him. It doesn't bother him in that respect anymore. So maybe this time, the time might be right for him to add his own account in more detail to the record. But we'll wait and see. But I can understand why he didn't want to be involved. But that's, you know, I kept having these questions in my mind as I'm going through it. I wonder what Calvin would make of that. Did that happen to Calvin also? And so on and so on. So maybe I might get some answers to those questions in the new year. You never know.
Mm-hmm. So we are out of time, but thank you so much for sharing this with us. You run the Flying Disc Press, and people can find you at flyingdiscpress.blogspot.co.uk. That's where they can find all of your books. I believe all your books are also up at Amazon.
They are indeed, and I'm forever grateful of anyone's support, because I am just a one-man band, Alejandro.
Mm-hmm. Well, we love promoting what you do, because what you do is so important. You're a leading voice out there, and if we didn't have you, I think we wouldn't. A lot of important research and information wouldn't come to light. So thank you so much for contributing to OpenMinds.tv and for what you do.
My pleasure, Alejandro. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Philip Mantle for joining us today for the show. Really, really interesting stuff. His website is flyingdiscpress.blogspot.com. Just to remind you, you can also just Google Flying Disc Press and you'll find it. You'll have more information about Philip and what he's up to, the different podcasts and interviews that he does, and his books. So you may recall some of the other books he's published, and I think we've had him on the show probably for most of them, but UFOs Over Romania, UFOs Today, UFOs Over Poland, and that is just to name a few of the really important books that he has published at Flying Disc Press. So check that out. Of course, this interview was before the big news came out, so it'd be very interesting to hear his views on that, and I'm sure he is sharing them also at his website and in other places, so check that out. Maybe he'll even do a show for us at some point. I guess also he has done something for the BBC or some local media out there in the UK where they've asked him about the topic. So he's kind of one of those go-to guys for the media out there. So really cool guy, isn't it? His voice is fun, too. He's got a great voice. That accent, you just feel like you're in the English countryside when you're talking to Philip. As for that big news, of course, like I said, this story is evolving by the moment, so be sure to check out openminds.tv. It's evolving so quickly. If you're not on social media, probably most of you are if you're podcast listeners, but be sure to follow me on my podcast and my Twitter, and also Open Minds and the UFO Congress, because we also have updates on a regular basis for the UFO Congress. And you got to remember, we got to take some credit and kind of, I told you so, and pat ourselves on the back, I feel, at the UFO Congress, because this Tom DeLonge thing, you know, when we posted our UFO, our year, Researcher of the Year award for him, that created a big news flurry earlier in the year, and hopefully helped, you know, the momentum that kept going until later in the year, and this whole thing that's going on right now. And of course, Tom loves the Congress. He's been there before secretly. You didn't know. You might have sat right next to him at dinner. And we will have something. Hopefully, he'll even be joining us at the Congress this year. But we've got a lot of really, really cool stuff going on there. We posted the schedule. You're going to have to check out some of these speakers. Go to ufocongress.com to check that out. ufocongress.com. You got to be there. Come on. You got to say hi. You got to give me a high five and we can meet. It'll be a lot of fun. So check it out at ufocongress.com. But that is our show for today. Thank you so much for the gentleman who created the opening and close music, Caleb Hanks. Thank you to Systematics for the bumper music. Thank you to Martin, even though he wasn't here, he was supportive, and, you know, we've been in contact. I hope everything went well for him, and we'll have him back, that's for sure. And, of course, as always, thank you, the listener. Until next time, adios, muchachos.